David Lynch captivates and mystifies audiences with luxurious cinematic dreamscapes, creating glorious puzzles for the minds and hearts of film fans. Three titles in particular, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire, his unofficial California trilogy, feature characters with blurred identities embarking on perplexing paths in search of their lost selves. In this audio digest, Laura Stewart reads Ashley Harris's Finding Out About Life on David Lynch's Lost Highway, Lindsay Stamhue's David Lynch's 10 Clues to Unlocking Mulholland Drive, and Cameron Crane's Inland Empire, A Woman in Trouble. For more audio content, consider joining our Patreon over at patreon.com/25YL. But for now, let's get lost in LA.
Lynch Night. Finding Out About Life on David Lynch's Lost Highway, as written by Ashley Harris and read by Laura Stewart. It's difficult, now that Twin Peaks The Return exists, to not look at all of David Lynch's output as one cohesive stream of artistic development. The Return proved to be a shining jewel on the crown of David Lynch's career as a filmmaker, incorporating themes and imagery that he has explored since he began to realise his dream to make paintings move. Lost Highway beams is a brilliant example of the themes that David Lynch has consistently examined and acts as a distinct jumping-off point that Lynch would propel himself from when he made Mulholland Drive. It was clear in just the 4 years between Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive that David Lynch was conditioned to explore the blurred line between fantasy and reality and the transformation of self. Like all of David Lynch's films, Lost Highway is easier to accept and enjoy if it's looked at as a stream of consciousness journey. Another theme that Lynch focuses on, especially in Lost Highway, is desire, and how that has the potential to take over our subconscious and influence every aspect of our lives. Mulholland Drive is believed by many to be David Lynch's best film, and if one accepts that as the deep end of his filmography, then Lost Highway must exist in that same pool. A film that only enhances the experience of finally making it to the deep end. I get disheartened when I hear Lost Highway referred to as a lesser Lynch, or even worse, ignored altogether, because it is such a rich film that no other filmmaker could have made. Lost Highway is a film so emblazoned with David Lynch's fingerprint that it deserves top shelf appreciation, along with the rest of his works. A film that leaves all those who encounter it forever grappling through its unique trip down the drain of desire and through the complicated web of reality and fantasy. The first time I saw Lost Highway, I was instantly reminded of Michael Haneke's Caché. In both films, the couples introduced to the audience are unnerved by a series of videos left on their doorstep, recording their comings and goings or the front of their house. The similarities end there, but the initial connection was one that intrigued me, as Haneke and Lynch are personal favourites of mine for the way their films penetrate the superficial aspects of humanity. In a Hitchcock-esque move, David Lynch introduces us to a couple, Fred Madison, played by Bill Pullman, and Renee Madison, played by Patricia Arquette, that will be discarded close to the midway point of the film. Fred plays saxophone at a jazz club under plenty of blue lights, a favourite of David Lynch's, and Renee seems to be expected to be at every whim a stern yet moody musician. The couple is childless, barely communicate, and is clearly unhappy. The one time we do see them making love appears to be an emotionally cold experience, another common thread in the work of David Lynch. Because of the emotional distance in their relationship, the mystery of the sudden appearance of the tapes on their doorstep rattles them more so than if they had a more solid foundation. The couple also lives life in a closed-off way, happy to sequester themselves from the outside world. Each successive tape left on their door is more disturbing than the last, and the couple becomes even more unsettled. When one of the tapes reveals the murder of Renee, Fred is arrested and taken into police custody. While in solitary confinement, Fred has disappeared, but he has been inexplicably replaced by Pete Dayton, played by Baltasar Getty. The police are baffled. Pete can't even describe how he was transported into the cell, and after a fashion is set free. Once released, Pete resumes work as a mechanic, spends time with his friends, and continues the aimless relationship with his girlfriend Sheila, played by Natasha Gregson-Wagner. Suddenly, though, his life takes a disturbing turn. It begins to mirror Fred's when a beautiful blonde is introduced. As Pete navigates his own life, he recalls memories of Fred's. He begins to develop debilitating headaches when Fred's music is played, and a nosebleed and severe hallucinations are brought on when he sees a picture of Fred's wife, who looks exactly like his new blonde love interest. As he so commonly does, David Lynch has presented a mystery with Lost Highway, pieces of a puzzle that don't depend on being solved as much as they do on being experienced. A David Lynch film is an experience. His unique soundscapes and disorientating camera effects are designed to take the audience out of their comfort zone and impose upon them feelings that they could otherwise try to ignore. Lost Highway is full of unusual camera angles, especially after the transformation from Fred to Pete, reminding the audience that what is seen on screen can't necessarily be trusted. In this interesting way, the camera in Lost Highway almost acts as a hindrance between the characters and the audience, rather than a bridge. In a more comforting film, the audience is pulled in and coaxed into understanding, and the director intends on the audience solving the mystery. Contrary to this method, David Lynch sets out to prove, in each of his films, that the world isn't a clean space wherein everything makes sense and can be explained. One of the reasons why I love David Lynch's films so much is because they break through the facade of what we think life is. Even in the most picturesque places, we can discover the most sinister realities. Fred was hiding a world of emotions beneath his surface as a musician. He seemed to bottle his worst traits and present them as idiosyncrasies that aided his music. His walls needed to be soundproofed so he could play saxophone, but what ended up being built in his home was a barrier between him and his wife. The soundproofing was much easier to accomplish than an acceptance that life can't be so easily blockaded, and we often have to confront the issues that trouble us emotionally. Perhaps the transformation from Fred to Pete, in some way, signalled the audience to the fact that Fred had shunned or been complacent towards everything that had troubled him, and when he finally encountered a situation he couldn't ignore, his body didn't know how to handle it except for his conscience to flee. Oftentimes, in a film directed by David Lynch, we will see his camera linger on a hand pressing a buzzer a bit too long, or feel our frustrations mount as we watch an envelope sit on the ground at someone's feet longer than we feel it should take that person to pick it up. Lynch isn't interested in handing the audience what they want, or fast-forwarding to the climax without first going through the mundane. One can definitely understand that, for Lynch, the journey is all that's important. There is no concept of getting to the point. We will arrive at the point exactly when he wants us to. That sometimes slow, yet deliberate style pushed some new fans away in my experience of watching Twin Peaks The Return. But those it didn't push away were rewarded tenfold by the time the auteur took us to where we were going. An aspect of Lost Highway I hadn't before been tuned into was the use of close-ups, especially of the eyes and mouth. I hadn't noticed Lynch use this technique in Mulholland Drive, but hadn't noticed the prevalence of close-ups in previous viewings of Lost Highway. Perhaps this is another way for Lynch to help us break through the facade of the individual. The break between what is real and what is an illusion, and the powerful feeling of desire, seem to be addressed by David Lynch using these close-ups in Lost Highway. Even when we are looking at someone, no matter how close to them we are, we can never be sure exactly who we are looking at. This idea of being able to live as another self in a fantasy is one that Lynch likes to explore. For Fred, the fantasy of living as Pete could endure until he started to break and revert to his former self. Knowing Lynch's commitment to transcendental meditation, I can't help but wonder how much the idea of minimizing a thought to experience each state of the thought, as preached by the method's adherents, influences Lynch's fascination with becoming another person. Renee was empowered to a degree when she became Alice Wakefield, in a sense that she was more a part of the human relationships she maintained rather than simply being a non-active participant in her marriage to Fred. She had desires she could more acutely realise when her fantasy life evolved than when she was listlessly stuck in her marriage to Fred. Sexual frustration in Lost Highway is interestingly evaluated in the character of Renee or Alice. Lost Highway was a film so ahead of its time as a neo-noir fantasy crime-ridden love story that it had a bit of trouble finding its audience upon its release in 1997. Fortunately, the worlds David Lynch creates are so multi-layered, they lend themselves well to multiple viewings and deep analysis. Even though we had to wait 20 years, Lost Highway has grown in critical support and carved a strong place for itself within the filmography of David Lynch. An element of fantasy exists in each of Lynch's films. Lost Highway, however, plants that fantasy more firmly in a genre, making it easier to draw similarities to the film and the human condition. The slow fades and the ethereal whooshing we have grown to expect from David Lynch, coupled with the minimalist yet engrossing sets, build a world unlike any other offered in cinema. There is hardly any furniture or decorations in Fred and Rennie's house, yet I understand their living room to be more real than I do many more elaborate ones depicted on screen. I find Lynch's commitment to understanding the nature of human beings and the multiple aspects of themselves they present a fascinating concept to flesh out through cinema. Much like the long stretch of highway opening the film, human life can become so ritualistic and hypnotic due to all that we don't wish to confront being pushed into an inaccessible point below our surfaces. We begin knowing where we are going, but can become lost not by confronting the truer natures of ourselves, leaving many to indulge in their fantasies and desires as a coping mechanism from having to face our real lives. Lynch's Lost Highway proves, however, that we can only remember things our own way, not necessarily the way they happened, and only for so long before our fantasy crumbles. Lynch Night. David Lynch's 10 Clues to Unlocking Mulholland Drive. As written by Lindsay Samhuth and read by Laura Stewart. Mulholland Drive was the first Lynch film I watched after my first time getting through Twin Peaks nearly 10 years ago. It was a hot July night and we had just moved into our new apartment, lovely and spacious, in a brick building on a tree-lined street called Old Fort Road, because it used to lead directly down the riverbank to the ferry that took settlers to the original trading fort on the north side of the North Saskatchewan River. Nothing at all like the twisting and winding road that snakes along the top of the Santa Monica Mountains, the road that gives this film its name and its atmosphere. I was on summer holidays, the perks of being a teacher, and my husband was out at a work event, leaving me with hours alone and nothing to do. So I popped the DVD into our player and settled in with my snacks. I thought I knew what to expect. I'd seen Twin Peaks. It'd be like that, right? But when the film finished, I realised that my equilibrium had shifted ever so slightly. Totally bowled over, I was completely unable to think of anything else. I tried, so help me, I tried. But after the final credits ran, within an hour, I restarted the film and watched it again. And then I watched it a third time. I was still watching it into the night when Aidan returned home. What is it about this film that does this? I don't know that I can answer that without landing in the cliché. Most people know that Lynch got the idea for it during his Twin Peaks days and intended for it to be a vehicle to get Audrey Horne to Los Angeles. It was originally commissioned as a TV pilot, and the final act of the film, The Big Twist, was written and filmed after the project became a film instead. This final act is the destabilizer, the part that causes most people such consternation. It's beautiful and gauzy in places, reminiscent of the storied golden age of Hollywood. It's gritty too, where you least expect it. There are palm trees and sunshine just around the corner from the places where the darkest fears reside. The whole film is as dark and winding as the road it's named after, and the locus where it all begins. Mulholland Drive seems, to me at least, to be rather straightforward once you know what it is you're looking at. The answers are there, in the film and, in this case, in Lynch's 10 clues to help viewers navigate this world, which we'll talk about in a moment. In order to properly discuss the film, I will have no choice but to delve into the plot details and particulars of the story itself. Therefore, consider this your spoiler warning. The story. In my view, the first two-thirds of the film are some kind of idealised dream world vision of the life that the characters in the last third ultimately led. Of course, there are as many interpretations of this film as there are viewers, so your mileage may vary. Here's the short version, as I see it. Diane Selwyn, played by Naomi Watts, is a struggling actress at the end of a failed love affair with Camilla Rhodes, Laura Harring. In a moment of despair after learning that Camilla has been killed by the hitman Diane hired, Diane kills herself. In her death throes, the vision of her idealised life appears, in which she has cast herself as pretty and peppy Betty Elms, while Camilla becomes Rita, the amnesiac. In this world, conspiracies and mystery abound, and every bad thing that has happened to Diane is explained away as the product of someone else's machinations, and not the fault of her own limitations or bad choices. The film employs many common filmic tropes to get this idea across, but it is still a jarring switch. Characters you think you know show up with different names and personalities. Realities shift. Conventional linear storytelling is skewed for time jumps. And most alarmingly, the largest portion of the film, in this interpretation anyway, isn't even real, but is wholly imagined by the protagonist. Lynch's 10 Clues to Unlocking This Thriller. This is a serious departure for Lynch, who famously avoids discussing his films and their meanings with anyone. But for the Mulholland Drive DVD release, it seems an exception was made. My assumption is that this is because of studio interference. The film did well commercially and critically, and still routinely comes out near the top of many best-of lists. But in order to capitalise on the buzz and ensure the widest possible appeal, these 10 clues were included as a simple insert in the place of traditional audio commentary with the home release, in order to avoid alienating some home audiences. Because of Lynch's distaste for explanation, I have to wonder how many of these clues are red herrings, and how many are genuine. Some feel a little too on the nose, while others are sufficiently open-ended enough to allow for interpretation. My colleague John Bernardi made the observation recently that they seem very much like the instructions Lynch gives to his actors on set, as seen in the Twin Peaks The Return Blu-ray special features. I couldn't agree more. It seems that there is a significant amount of interpretation required to unpack these clues. 10 clues are as follows. 1. Pay particular attention in the beginning of the film. At least 2 clues are revealed before the credits. Number 2. Notice appearances of the red lampshade. 3. Can you hear the title of the film that Adam Kesher is auditioning actresses for? Is it mentioned again? 4. An accident is a terrible event. Notice the location of the accident. 5. Who gives a key and why? 6. Notice the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cup. 7. What is felt, realised and gathered at the Club Silencio? 8. Did talent alone help Camilla? 9. Note the occurrences surrounding the man behind Winkies. 10. Where is Aunt Ruth? So how do these clues stack up? Do they help with understanding the film? And what do they actually refer to? I think they're worth going through one by one. Shall we? Number 1. Pay particular attention in the beginning of the film. At least 2 clues are revealed before the credits. Various interpretations of this clue have led people to assigning meaning to different aspects of the opening sequence. Most people point to the jitterbug contest as one of the clues. This is most obviously a reference to the jitterbug contest that Diane claims she won, which led her to acting and to Hollywood. However, the name Betty is overheard in this opening sequence, which suggests that it might be Betty, the innocent alter ego of Diane, who won the contest, which further suggests that Diane might have been making the whole thing up. That Betty, or Diane, appears as a ghostly and washed-out image overlaid atop the jitterbuggers could be seen as a clue that Diane is dead. We also see duplicates of dancing couples. which could be a clue some have interpreted to mean that doubles or dual personalities or roles will play a part in the film we're about to see. That the scene shifts from Betty or Diane to first-person view, accompanied by heavy breathing, which some have interpreted as the sound of cocaine being snorted, is suggestive. Are we watching things from her point of view? The scene ends with a head falling into a pillow, which might clue us in to the fact that what is coming is nothing but a dream. 2. Notice appearances of the red lampshade. Red lampshades appear in three places within Mulholland Drive. The first appearance, chronologically, is during what is called the Byzantine Conspiracy, when Mr. Rock is trying to summon a woman to him. The call goes unanswered, but we see that the phone is next to a red lampshade. There are several possible interpretations for this, including that the call was meant for the Diane Selwyn, whose decaying body Betty and Rita discover in the Sierra Bonita apartment complex, because we later see a red lampshade next to a telephone in that apartment. It could also be that this phone call is meant for Betty Elms, who, in the fantasy version of her life, is being highly sought out by the Hollywood elite, represented by Mr. Rock. Another interpretation is that this is a psychological moment of denial on the part of Diane, who can't bear to answer the phone and reckon with the fact that she is the cause of her misery. A similar red lampshade is seen in an antique store in the Pink's hot dog scene with Betty or Diane lookalike prostitute, and the hitman is interested in this vein. This is a scene filled with red objects, and yet it takes place outside of Pink's hot dogs. The prostitute in this scene moves away from Pink and towards Red's, which might be seen as symbolic of Diane's move away from innocence to sin, possibly even to prostitution herself. That acting is often compared to prostitution might be a link here as well. Diane may feel that she has had to sell herself in order to become a star. She has been used and abused by the Hollywood system and has fallen into a degraded state that she subconsciously links to prostitution. The third red lampshade is seen in the final third of the film when we realise that the ringing phone we saw in the Byzantine conspiracy scene was, in fact, exactly the same as Diane's own phone. Is this the same moment as before? Are we just seeing it in context this time around? Possibly. It would be a perfect example of Lynch's non-linear storytelling. In this scene, she answers the phone and is invited to the party at 6980 Mulholland Drive, during which she is humiliated by Camilla and takes the decision to take out a contract on her life. 3. Can you hear the title of the film that Adam Kesher is auditioning actresses for? Is it mentioned again? The title of the film is The Sylvia North Story, and we do hear it in the first part of the film during the scene when Betty is taken to meet Adam, ostensibly for her to audition for the lead role in this film. This is after Betty blows everyone away at her audition for Bob Brooker, the audition her aunt set up for her, when we are led to believe that Betty is actually a gifted ingenue, talented enough to make waves in this industry. Ultimately, she doesn't even get to audition for the role in The Sylvia North Story. We know that Adam is being blackmailed and that the lead actress has already been selected, and Adam has no choice in the matter. We see this pre-selected actress audition here as Camilla Rhodes, Melissa George. It's clear from the way this scene is shot that Betty and Adam had a connection, and Adam would probably have loved to see Betty audition, and she likely would have blown him away as well. But behind the scenes, conspiracy keep this from materialising. We hear the title again in the final third, at the Mulholland Drive house party, when it is revealed that both Diane and Camilla auditioned for the role with director Bob Brooker, but Camilla ultimately won the role. This startling reversal sheds light on the earlier scene, and is one major reason for people suggesting that the first two thirds are an idealised portrait of Diane's life as a failed film actress. On his blog Reeling Back, Michael Walsh dug up the interesting tidbit that there is a bus in the Snoqualmie Valley called the Sylvia North. Perhaps this is where the inspiration for this name came from. 4. An accident is a terrible event. Notice the location of the accident. The accident that kills off the central plot of the first two-thirds takes place on Mulholland Drive. This is the same road where Camilla and Adam's home is, and where they host their party. Rita experiences the hijacking and car accident that drives her amnesia and starts the plot moving with Betty. It's notable that the car crash happens in the same location as when Diane exits the car and is led through the forest by Camilla to the party. It could be symbolic of the accident that Diane makes in ordering the hit on Camilla, or the accident that was Diane's acceptance of the invitation by Camilla to the party. Both Rita, in the dream, and Diane, in reality, utter the same line when the car stops, possibly further linking the two women with the accident and Diane's mistakes. 5. Who gives a key and why? There are three keys given prominence in the story, but the first is the only one that is truly given, by Coco to Betty when she first arrives at her aunt's home in Havenhurst. This allows Betty to enter her aunt's home and we meet Rita, who has snuck into the house and is sleeping off her concussion following the car accident on Mulholland Drive the night before. The second key is found by Betty and Rita at Club Silencio, near the end of the fantasy dream, and is soon after used by Rita to open the mysterious blue box that she's had in her possession since she showed up at Havenhurst with no memory. Betty disappears at the moment the key and the box are present in the scene together. Rita disappears when the box is finally opened. The third key is left for Diane by the hitman, as proof that Camilla has been killed. It represents the completion of the terrible deed and confirmation of the darkness within Diane that allowed the hit to be carried out in the first place. Since Coco is the only one to actually give anyone a key, it's worth examining the relationship that Coco has with the girls. She is open and flamboyant with Betty and distrustful of Rita, whom she never meets. She is also sympathetic towards Diane at the dinner party, where it is revealed that she is Adam's mother and that she doesn't think very highly of her son's dalliance with Camilla. Perhaps Diane imagines that Coco is the one giving Betty the key, because it mitigates some of the guilt that Diane feels over having Camilla killed. If Coco's even slightly on Diane's side regarding Adam and Camilla, it stands to reason that she would be a friendly face in the fantasy, and that the key, receipt of which was an indicator of an evil deed in the real world, would symbolise something friendlier, or at least less hostile in the fantasy world. Number 6. Notice the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cup. Several robes are worn by characters in Mulholland Drive. Betty's aunt leaves Betty a beautiful robe at Havenhurst, but Betty never gets to wear it. Only Rita is ever seen wearing the richly brocaded garment. Betty owns a hot pink bathrobe of her own, which she wears in the rehearsal scene with Rita, whose robe is deep red with black trim. Similar to the Pink's hot dog scene mentioned earlier, it seems as though this is another indication that Diane is struggling to reconcile her own innocence via Betty's pink robe and the sinful lust that will lead her astray, Rita's red robe. In the real world, Diane is seen wearing a dingy white robe in her apartment at Sierra Bonita. Not pure white, which might have been another representation of innocence, but dirtied white. Diane has been sullied. The ashtrays are also notable. There's one beside the red lampshade, which is filled with cigarette butts. These are covered in red lipstick, which is makeup that Camilla wears. It's an indication that Camilla and Diane shared cigarettes in the recent past, or that Diane simply can't clean her lover's lipstick-stained cigarette butts from her life just yet. The piano ashtray that is collected by Diane's neighbour is also interesting, but we'll get to that. Coffee cups are also plentiful. There are coffee cups at Winkies, coffee, espresso, being served to the Italians at the board meeting, and coffee being brewed by a Diane at the end of the film. Which of all of these are the robe, ashtray and coffee cup that we're meant to pay attention to? I believe it's the real world accoutrements in Diane's apartment. Her dirty white robe, coffee cup and the ashtray that she gives to her neighbour are all subsequently replaced in the flashback that happens next. Diane is shown topless wearing jeans. Her coffee has become a glass of whiskey, and the piano ashtray is still there, meaning it hasn't been returned to the neighbour. This could simply be an example of Lynch drawing our attention to the non-linear storytelling. But I also think it's a reminder to pay attention to what we're seeing, as it's not always what we think it is. 7. What is felt, realised and gathered at the Club Silencio? The Club Silencio scene marks the high emotional watermark of the film. Betty feels sadness and fear, realises that nothing is real, and gathers the blue box through which the enigmatic ending manifests. To take this further, Diane seems to feel love for Camilla, and possibly feels guilt over her murder. She realises that this is the end, and that she and Camilla will finally be joined together in death. Silencio in this scene could be a reference to the eternal silence of death. It is foreshadowing Diane's suicide in the final moments of the film. It's notable here that we might be forced to blur the lines between what we see on screen and what we experience as we watch the film. We are told that everything is an illusion, that everything is recorded. Does that mean that the club is an illusion? Everything in the world of Betty and Rita? The whole film? Are we, the audience, being reminded that nothing we see is real, too? 8. Did talent alone help Camilla? In the fantasy sequence, Betty sees Camilla Rhodes audition for Adam Kesher. What she doesn't know is that Camilla has been pre-selected for the role that she eventually wins in Adam's film, The Sylvia North Story. This could be interpreted as Diane's rationalisation for why she didn't get the role when she auditioned alongside Camilla for the role in the real world. A grand conspiracy kept her from booking the role of a lifetime. So, in the fantasy sequence, talent alone did not help Camilla. How about in the real world? We have no indication that Camilla is a bad actress who is helped along the way by outside forces, but we do learn that the director, Bob Brooker, the same director whom Betty auditioned for and impressed in the fantasy sequence, didn't think much of Diane, and that this is why she didn't win the role in reality. However, it's also possible that Camilla used some other means to get the role, and this is why Coco doesn't think very highly of her. We simply don't know. What we do know is that Diane was jealous of Camilla's success, and either believes herself to be more deserving of it, or believes that the deck was stacked against her by forces beyond her ken. In either case, Camilla is the girl. Whether she's the girl that the Italians are forcing Adam to hire for the Sylvia North story, or the one that Diane has asked Joe the hitman to murder. 9. Notice the occurrences surrounding the man behind Winkies. One of the most terrifying sequences in any film, I'd argue, to date, occurs behind Winky's diner. When we first meet the bum, played by Bonnie Ahrens, it is notable that the scene is the same as what occurs in a dream that Dan, Patrick Fischler, is describing to Herb, Michael Cook. In fact, the reality of the scene in the diner is eerily similar to Dan's dream, to the point that it may have become his dream by the end of the scene. The lines are so blurred by this point it's hard to say. We see Winkies 3 times in total, but only see the bum twice. Once at the end of Dan and Herb's scene, and once at the end when Diane takes the contract out on Camilla's life. Rita and Betty pore over newspapers in the idealised version of Hollywood that Diane has dreamed up, but they never see the bum. I think this is important. Facing the evil in the back of this place is something that Dan has to do. It matters little whether this is a dream or reality, because either way Dan dies as a result of this meeting. Facing that evil is not something that even occurs to Rita and Betty when they share a cup of coffee and pore over the newspaper, in the same booth as Dan and Herb had been in, looking for clues as to the circumstances of Rita's accident the day before. It's also not something that Diane is able to do when she has her scene at Winkies in the last third. We don't know what this evil represents for Dan, though it's possible to infer what it means to Diane. Her inability to proactively face this evil in this scene is what unleashes the old couple from the blue box. If Diane won't face her demons, in fact if she constructs a whole alternate reality in order to avoid them, her demons will come to face her. Much like later interpretations of Twin Peaks The Return, and Audrey's role as realised in Part 16, does waking up from a dream cause the death of the characters within the dream? Is Dan's death after seeing the bum because he has woken up from his dream? That is entirely possible. Number 10. Where is Aunt Ruth? In Betty's fantasy, Aunt Ruth is away in Canada filming a movie. We have no reason to doubt Betty's account, as this was during a period in time when the film industries of Hollywood North, in places like Vancouver and Toronto, were seeing an uptick in big Hollywood productions being filmed there, and for a fraction of the cost. Aunt Ruth is simply a part of this very real-life phenomenon, which was seen by many in the industry as an annoyance at best, or a harbinger of things to come. Like the decentralisation of that star-making machinery, at worst. In reality, we learn that Aunt Ruth is long dead, and that an inheritance from her is what funded Diane's move to Hollywood from Deep River, Ontario. Betty's assertion that Aunt Ruth is filming a movie in Canada could be seen as a subtle old Hollywood allusion to Ruth's actual death, as making a movie in Canada was at one time a euphemism for death. But then how does Aunt Ruth return at the end of the film? It could be another flashback to the moment when she left Havenhurst at the start of the fantasy. It could be a flashback even further to a point when she was still living, 10 or 20 years before the events of Diane's last days. It could be the start of the reality sequence, the first person we meet from Diane's real life, recast as Aunt Ruth in the fantasy, but seen here in her actual guise as a real, unnamed person, someone that Diane met and remembered and brought into her dream world as her dead aunt. It's cryptic and strange, and not at all answerable definitively. So these are the 10 clues. I set off to write this with the hope of understanding why Lynch included these 10 clues in the DVD release. They seem to be an anathema to his way of working. I didn't believe that they were necessary to fully understand the film, but as I worked my way through the clues, I've come to see that they aren't as misleading as they once seemed. Are they strictly necessary? No, I don't believe they are. You can watch the film without interpreting these clues, and you could also interpret these clues in different ways. Like John Bernardi said, perhaps they were intended not as absolute clues pointing us to answers, but rather as interpretive clues guiding us to our own ways of looking at the film. Has this changed my view of the film? No. I still see it as an exploration of the dark underbelly of Hollywood. This isn't a pretty Hollywood. There's nothing glamorous about it. The Lynch's Hollywood is not the Hollywood that we're sold every February during the Oscars, or the one that gleams and shines under that too clear sunshine on the Walk of Fame. He has never been interested in showing us that, unless it's to contrast the darkness lurking underneath. We should read Betty Elms the way we read Blue Velvet's White Picket Fence. The real story, the heart of it all, is buried underneath the bugs and vermin. This is where Diane lives. Pinland Empire blogger Marcus writes that the Lynch in Los Angeles is often a place where minds are lost. Indeed, Lynch himself has said that, and I quote, "A great actor or actress, they give up themselves and they become somebody else. And everybody, myself included, sometimes wants to get lost and to find themselves in a new world, and film gives you that chance to get lost completely in another world." Acting, according to this definition anyway, sounds like a form of madness, a kind of schizophrenic fracturing of the actor's personality. If that's true, it makes a terrible amount of sense that Hollywood be a place of madness, and this is exactly what Lynch's LA trilogy, and specifically Diane's story in Mulholland Drive, explore. Diane absolves herself of any blame for her misfortune as she dies, even if only in the fantasy world of her creation, because it's the only way her madness allows her to find peace. I've been to Los Angeles 3 times since seeing Mulholland Drive for the first time, and each time I've managed to find my way to Mulholland Drive. Sometimes it's accidental, and other times it's deliberate. Stopping at the lookouts along the way, I've seen Hollywood to the south, and I've seen the valley to the north, in daylight and moonlight. I've sped along its sunlit curves in the heat of Southern California afternoon, and slowed to a crawl at the dead of night because I thought something was keeping pace with my car on the side of the road. I've never stumbled across an amnesiac fleeing the scene of a car accident, nor have I encountered a mysterious woman beckoning me to the woods with the promise of deadly mystery and intrigue. But being on this road makes me feel, every time, as if that's possible. Hollywood is the place where dreams come true, but, at least in Lynch's hands, it is also the place where dreams become nightmares. Woman in Trouble, as written by Cameron Crane and read by Laura Stewart. A little boy went out to play. When he opened his door, he saw the world. As he passed through the doorway, he caused a reflection. Evil was born. Evil was born and followed the boy. And the variation, a little girl went out to play, lost in the marketplace, as if half born, then not through the marketplace, you see that, don't you? But through the alley behind the marketplace. This is the way to the palace, but it isn't something you remember. Inland Empire is a film about a woman in trouble. But this is not to say it is about a particular woman, no. The indefinite article here precisely points to something indefinite. It is not a matter of the woman who is in trouble, neither in the sense of the troubles that pertain to a specific woman, nor in one that makes a claim about some kind of essence of femininity. A woman, always singular and meaningfully alone, even with others. Any woman, any given woman, but again, not in a way that defines a category, although perhaps what is at play is a more concrete universality. When the film was released in 2006, I was fortunate enough to be able to see it at the theatre at the IFC here in New York. My girlfriend at the time, whom I had exposed by that point to almost all of Lynch's extant work, came with me. I recall that, as we left the theatre, she said something like, "I thought that was easier to follow than his other stuff." She wasn't wrong. Inland Empire might seem like a totally incomprehensible film from one point of view, if one is focused on trying to pin it down in terms of a linear narrative, but from another, it is all too easy to understand. There is a theme here, and a story that might not make sense in terms of logic, but which certainly does on a more intuitive level. Most films, even those that feature women in prominent roles, stem from a male perspective. This is not only because most directors and screenwriters have traditionally been men, it cuts to something deeper. And it's not just in the film industry. Everything is imbued with a masculine point of view, from our entertainment to our philosophy. Everywhere we get men's stories and a male point of view. This is the significance of thinking about something like the Bechdel test, which Inland Empire passes right out of the gate. Lynch's film should thus be seen as a commentary on being a woman in a patriarchal world, and a critique of the film industry. Besides the fact that the film meaningfully centres around a film within the film, this latter point is well evidenced by the fact that Inland Empire was independently produced and distributed, and by Lynch's For Your Consideration campaign for Laura Dern. I well recognise that there is something fraught about the fact that I, a man, will be contending this piece that David Lynch, a man, has made a film that gets at the experience of being a woman. Perhaps I'm not in the best position to assess the accuracy of the depiction. Perhaps it all remains a bit abstract for me. As I think about Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex and things that women have told me, I recognise this, and yet I argue that Inland Empire is a feminist film. May the proof be, as they say, in the pudding, or not. Woman as Other. Jean-Paul Sartre points primarily to three aspects of the human condition in his existentialism as humanism: anguish, abandonment, and despair. And on a first pass, these seem fairly gender neutral. One encounters anguish in relation to the fact that in living, one must decide what to do. Indecision itself is a form of decision, inaction a kind of action. I must decide, but in deciding I imply that I have made the right decision. This is what Sartre means when he talks about deciding for all of humanity. It is not just that my action is what I think I should do, it lays a claim as to what one should do. Yet, on what basis could one decide? God is dead and we are alone. Abandonment, after all. No moral system could tell Sartre's student whether to go fight the Nazis or stay home with his mother in desperate straits, etc. He had to decide. And it was his decision itself that showed what it is that he valued more. Existence precedes essence. There is no human nature, but rather one is what one does. We are condemned to be free. Further, we cannot count on others. Or perhaps we can when it comes to friends and so on. There can be solidarity, but one cannot count on humanity in general. The future is wide open, to be determined by the collective free existences that make up the species. Thus, despair. To act without hope, but one must act nonetheless. The famous, though oft misinterpreted line, "Hell is other people," which stems from Sartre's play No Exit, does not mean that people suck, or something like that. Rather, it stems from Sartre's distinction between being a subject and being an object. I am a subject insofar as I determine my existence freely. I decide what I will be through what I decide to do. But I am also under the gaze of others. They know me in ways I cannot know myself, and the views of others impact my view of myself. This is not only when I am with them, but potentially when I am alone, thinking about what others think of me. It is the way in which this impinges on my freedom as a subject that makes this hell. Sartre insists that one is always responsible for what one does, but he also notes that there is no meaningful difference between doing something and pretending to do it. This perhaps should be read in the direction opposite to some thought about authenticity, however. In fact, this would seem to be the point. It is bad faith to suggest that my action is in some instances a charade, that it is not me in some meaningful sense. But Sartre's way of thinking may not be sufficiently nuanced in this regard. Certainly there is a difference, for example, between the actor and the character being performed. But then how does this apply in day-to-day life, where I surely perform myself for others frequently? I am not the same with my grandmother as I am with my friend, and I am most surely not the same with my students. Rather than suggesting that there is some authentic self at the core of one's being, I would suggest that it is always one mask behind another, even in terms of how I present myself to myself, alone in a dark room. Is that gaze something I can truly escape, or is Sartre's notion of subjectivity perhaps a masculine fantasy? This is an even more pressing problem for a woman, insofar as she is asked to perform herself more consistently than is a man. She's asked to smile, respond to the unwanted attention of a male stranger, etc. Her being is caught up in being determined as an object in a pervasive way. It is in this sense that Simone de Beauvoir contends that woman is the other. I quote, "Now what peculiarly signalizes the situation of a woman is that she, a free and autonomous being like all human creatures, nevertheless finds herself living in a world where men compel her to assume the status of the other. They propose to stabilize her as an object and to doom her to immanence, since her transcendence is to be overshadowed and forever transcended by another ego, conscience, which is essential and sovereign. The drama of woman lies in this conflict between the fundamental aspirations of every subject, ego, who always regards the self as the essential and the compulsions of a situation in which she is the inessential. How can a human being in a woman's situation attain fulfillment? What roads are open to her, which are blocked? How can independence be recovered in a state of dependency? What circumstances limit women's liberty, and how can they be overcome? This is a man's world, and insofar as a woman is determined as other, and not as a man, she is in trouble." A woman in trouble. There is an ambiguous sense of dread in Inland Empire. It's not so much what happens, for the most part, as it is a feeling that pervades the film. And this is even more the case with adequate sound seen in theatre. There is a kind of low bass drone that you feel in your gut, something I have not been able to replicate at home, though that might be possible if you had a good enough sound system. This is the dread of being a woman in trouble. A woman is always in trouble, insofar as she is thrown into a patriarchal world defined by the gaze of men. though it is not just the men who are the problem. It is potentially other women, who view themselves through this same patriarchal lens. It is not just true subjectivity that is a problem, it is solidarity, as de Beauvoir also notes. Think here of a couple of scenes from the film in particular. One, the scene that centres around a discussion between women of Lanny's breasts. And two, the scene towards the end of the film wherein Nikki Grace, or Susan Blue, played by Laura Dern, lies bleeding from a stab wound. We don't see solidarity between women in these scenes. We see them together, but in separation from one another. We see them interpreting the world from the predominant masculine point of view, which precisely impedes solidarity insofar as it denies them the autonomy of subjects. Self-interest. You may be dying, lady, but how do I get to Pomona? This also explains the nature of the narrative of Inland Empire. It seems fractured because Laura Dern's character is actually always a character in the story of a man, even as the film proceeds from her perspective. That is, Inland Empire unfolds from the perspective of the other, which distinguishes it from perhaps every other film that exists. In the first scene, we see a man and a woman, their faces blurred because it doesn't matter who they are, except that she's a whore. And then we see her, crying as she stares at the TV. It's static, because it is all static, it doesn't matter. Images cut in and out, resolving on the rabbits. The patriarchal form is parodied throughout the rabbit scenes, which mimic cliched sitcom tropes, but evacuate them of their substance. This is about the form, a form we see all over the place. It's about a man and his family, but foundationally about the man. Who cares about the details? These merely distract us from the main thing, which is the staidness of Hollywood and its fundamental frame. What follows is a brief exchange between Yannick and Phantom, where the latter presses the former on the fact that he is looking for an opening, and the former understands. This is vague in the same way as the rabbits. The substance has been ripped out, as it were. What we get instead is a pure form of masculinity, the assertion of a kind of pure masculine desire to find an opening. For what? To what end? It doesn't matter. I understand. This is what men do, look for an opening. Indeed, the Phantom represents the darkest impulses of a man, the tendency to be a creep, to take pleasure in the degradation of women, to have a laugh about it, and you simply can't shoot that dead. When Nikki gets the role in On High in Blue Tomorrows, there is a worry that Devon will have an affair with her, which would be no good for perhaps multiple reasons, but key among them is Nikki's husband, Piotrek Krull, who even threatens him about it, more or less claiming his wife as his property. She is an object he owns. Devon is not interested in her at first, and tells his people not to worry, but he clearly becomes interested, and I would contend that he becomes interested precisely as the conquest becomes feasible. This isn't about love, but the way in which men can tend to be creeps. She is a part of his story, even as we see things from her point of view. And the same goes for the rest of the film. Take whatever man you want, whether it is the husband or the confessor, or whatever precisely he is supposed to be, and you will find the woman treated as an object, whether as a piece of property or an object of study or whatever. In this regard, it is significant that the bonus disc of the DVD is labelled as More Things That Happened. These aren't deleted scenes, in the sense of things that were cut from the film where the film remains the true thing. They are more in the sense that puts them on the same level. These are more things that happened to a woman in trouble. As the film proceeds, the lines blur between the characters Laura Dern portrays. At the beginning, she's an actress taking a role, but as time goes on, she becomes confused about this, as do we. Think of the scene wherein she tells Devon Burke, or Billy Side, played by Justin Theroux, that it's like a scene from their movie, before the camera pulls back to reveal that I guess it was. The duality of character names should key us into the blurring of the lines, but the important point is that this doesn't just pertain to actors. I perform myself constantly. Is there some stable self underlying these performances? A soul, perhaps, that makes them all hang together? But even if there were a soul, would that really help with regard to the issue? I still differ all over the place and seem incapable of experiencing something constant about myself. It's always now. If it was tomorrow, you would be sitting over there, as Grace Zabriskie says. Yet in this constant differing, perhaps there is something to be found about the human condition, the condition of a woman in trouble, determined through the male gaze, perhaps opens something broader. Perhaps, as Gilles Deleuze suggested, the majority is no one, and we are all other, struggling to be subjects in a world that works to make us objects. In this regard, the ending of Inland Empire strikes a hopeful tone. Women dancing together, solidarity at last. Perhaps Nikki, or Sue, did manage to kill the Phantom, or the patriarchy, and open up a true possibility for being a woman who is not in trouble. And perhaps man is also redeemed, once this Phantom has been destroyed. The Marine's sister, played by Tracy Ashton, arrives to the party, notably feeling accepted without regard to her disability. Laura Harring and Laura Dern blow kisses at one another and smile. The former grabs the hand of a man in a beanie, but there is nothing sexual about it. She's just letting him know that he's accepted, and he smiles as well. There is a monkey that is happy too. I don't really know what to say about the monkey. A multiplicity of women gather to dance. That their dance is choreographed is only to show us their solidarity at this point. A man saws wood to the side, focused on his labour and not on viewing the women as subjects. Monique Cash comes to the fore to lip-sync to Nina Simone's Cinnamon. Oh, Cinnamon, where are you gonna run to? All on that day, we gotta run to the rock. Please hide me. I run to the rock, but the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I ain't gonna hide you there, all on that day. I said, Rock, what's the matter with you, Rock? Don't you see I need you, Rock? Good Lord, Lord, all on that day. So I run to the river. It was bleeding. I run to the sea. It was boiling. I run to the sea. It was boiling all on that day. So I run to the Lord. Please hide me, Lord. Don't you see me praying? But the Lord said, go to the devil. The Lord said, all on that day. So I ran to the devil. He was waiting all on that day. We here get the whole theme of Inland Empire. A woman in trouble with no place to hide. Even the Lord, a man, turns her away. She was praying, but he nonetheless says she ought to have been praying. Her supplication has not been adequate, and yet she asserts her power, calling out to the good aspect of the man at the same time that she calls for the sinner man to repent. Don't you know that I need you? The end of Inland Empire gives us a vignette of the world where the patriarchy has been broken. Women find solidarity, and the men present treat them as subjects at last, accepting a kind hand, playing the piano as they dance, or sawing wood in their presence, and the monkey is happy.
Thank you for listening to this audio digest from 25yearslatersite.com. For 3 weekly audio articles and instant access to more than 50 already published audio articles, please join our Patreon at patreon.com/25yl. Music provided by Ryan Linich.